All right, welcome back to the deep dive. Today we're going to be looking into this really kind of fascinating issue that Paul addresses in 1 Corinthians 11, verses 17 through 34, and it concerns the early Christian community's observance of the Lord's Supper. And for this deep dive, I've got excerpts here from Dr. Gary Metter's lecture on this passage, and we're going to be using that to kind of guide our conversation. So our mission today is to understand the problems that Paul identifies and the significance of his response to this issue.
Yeah, and one of the things that I think is interesting right off the bat here is that Paul is transitioning from a discussion about the roles of men and women in worship, and then he kind of shifts into this discussion about the Lord's Supper without really any of the traditional transitional phrases that he usually uses. Like he doesn't say, now let's talk about this. He just kind of goes right into it.
Right. He just jumps into it.
Yeah. And so I think that highlights just how urgent this issue was for Paul.
Exactly. And it is quite a jarring issue that he's addressing because the Lord's Supper, which was meant to be the ultimate symbol of unity, a shared meal commemorating Christ's sacrifice, had actually become a point of division and was reinforcing social hierarchies.
Yeah. And it's interesting that when you read this passage and you start to think about the context of Corinth and how stratified their society was, what was happening at these gatherings for the Lord's Supper was actually mirroring the customs of secular Roman banquets.
Really?
Yeah. So it wasn't just a matter of like, oh, this is just how they do things in their culture. It was that their faith wasn't really reshaping their social interactions. The wealthy attendees were indulging themselves while the poorer members were left hungry.
Wow.
And essentially, they were being treated as lesser than.
Yeah, and you really see Paul's frustration with this in the text. He doesn't hold back at all. His opening statement in verse 17 is so direct. He says, "I have no praise for you, for your meetings do more harm than good."
Yeah.
That's really strong language.
Yeah, especially for Paul, who, in many of his letters, he tries to kind of balance out his corrections with some kind of encouragement. But here, he's just like, no, this is really bad.
Right. He gets straight to the point.
Yeah.
It's a huge problem.
And then he goes on to kind of break down the specific problems that he sees in their gathering.
Okay.
And the first one he mentions is that there are divisions among them.
Okay.
And he says this in verse 18. And, if you remember earlier in the letter, Paul had already addressed these issues of factions and rivalries within the church.
Right.
And so it seems like those social divisions were still really present,
Yeah.
even during their worship.
It's interesting too how he brings up status conflicts, right?
Yeah.
It's not just like they're disagreeing about, certain theological points or whatever, but there's this whole status thing going on.
Yeah, absolutely.
And he hints at this in verse 19, where he kind of makes this sarcastic comment about how there must be differences among them so that it can be shown who has God's approval.
Right.
It almost sounds like he's saying, like, oh, so you think because you're wealthy or because you have a certain status, that means that God likes you more. That's
Right.
kind of how it comes across.
Yeah, it's almost as if they're viewing their wealth or their status as a sign of divine favor.
Exact.
And that's influencing how they're treating one another at these communal meals.
Right.
Like, if they're blessed by God, then they deserve the best, right?
Exactly. Yeah. And then in verses 20 and 21, he really lays bare the reality of their gatherings. It's like they're not even waiting for each other. He says, "When you come together, it is not the Lord's supper you eat. For when you are eating, some of you go ahead with your own private suppers. As a result, one person remains hungry and another gets drunk." It's
Yeah.
really troubling what he's describing there.
Yeah, absolutely.
I mean, some people are just indulging themselves while others are going hungry. And even worse, some are getting drunk while others have nothing.
It's just a complete disregard for the needs of others.
Yeah, and it's so far removed from the spirit of the gospel, the whole point of them coming together as a church.
Right. It's like their individual desires and their focus on their own status is completely overshadowing everything else.
Yeah, and then he asks these really pointed questions in verse 22. "Don't you have homes to eat and drink in, or do you despise the church of God by humiliating those who have nothing?" Like, he's really challenging their behavior.
Yeah.
There's no room for misinterpretation here.
Right. It's a pretty strong indictment.
And so after this pretty harsh rebuke, Paul really shifts his focus.
Yeah.
He wants to get back to what the Lord's Supper should actually be.
Right.
And Dr. Metters points out that Paul then goes on to recount what's called the dominical tradition
Yeah.
in verses 23 through 26.
Right.
And this is where he really lays out the proper understanding and practice of this really crucial ritual. And it's interesting because he really emphasizes the authoritative transmission of this tradition. He uses words like received and delivered, saying, "For I received from the Lord what I also passed on to you."
Right.
Right.
Yeah, and it's not just Paul's opinion.
Right.
You know, he's presenting it as something that he received directly from Jesus.
Right.
And that he's passing on faithfully to the church.
And he really emphasizes the need for them to remember, right?
Yep.
He says, "For whenever you eat this bread and drink this cup, you proclaim the Lord's death until he comes."
Absolutely.
So it's not just about having a meal.
Right.
It's about remembering and proclaiming Christ's sacrifice.
Yeah, absolutely.
And this is where Dr. Metters points to an observation made by Bruce Winter, which is kind of fascinating. He says that Paul intentionally altered the word order in Greek when he's quoting Jesus's words about his body.
Oh, wow.
And this is a really subtle detail, but it could be quite significant.
So in what way did he change it?
So in Matthew, Mark, and Luke, the phrase is typically rendered as, "This is the body of me." But Paul writes, "This of me is the body."
Huh.
It's a small change, but it could make a big difference.
Yeah. And what kind of meaning does that have for us?
Well, according to Winter, this change in the word order really emphasizes Jesus's self-giving as a servant for them.
Oh, I see.
It's like by putting "of me" closer to "this is," he's highlighting the personal nature of Jesus's sacrifice on their behalf.
Mm.
And this, Winter argues, really underscores the selflessness of Christ's actions,
right,
which is in direct contrast to the selfish behavior of the Corinthians.
Exactly.
Like they're focused on themselves, and he's saying, "No, look at what Jesus did."
Yeah.
He gave himself up for you.
Right.
Like, that's the point of this meal. And he's also tying this back to one of his major themes, which is imitating Christ, right?
Right.
They're not imitating Christ in their relationships with each other. Right. They're completely missing the point. It's like, it's not just about getting the words right. It's about living them out.
Right.
Right?
Yeah. And the way that Paul changes the emphasis in this phrase is a powerful way of correcting their behavior. It's subtle, but it's so intentional.
Wow.
It makes you wonder what other little things we might be missing.
Right.
Yeah.
So it wasn't just that they were being socially insensitive.
Right.
Their behavior was actually completely contradictory to the whole foundation of the meal they were trying to absorb.
Right, exactly.
And then Paul gets into the consequences of participating in the Lord's Supper in an improper way.
Right.
Right. This is in the verses 27 through 34. And he warns against eating the bread or drinking the cup in an unworthy manner.
Yeah.
And Dr. Metters really makes a distinction here between in an unworthy manner and unworthily.
Huh.
So can you explain what that difference is?
Yeah. So the point here is not that a person should feel personally unworthy to take communion, like they're not a good enough Christian.
Okay.
But rather, it's about the manner in which they participate.
Okay.
So he's condemning this disrespectful and divisive way in which they were observing this meal.
Okay.
Because they were turning it into this self-serving event instead of this communal act of remembrance and unity.
I see.
So it's about honoring the spirit of the meal through your actions.
So like the act of not waiting for each other at the meal.
Right.
That directly contradicted this idea of selflessness, right?
Exactly. And Paul really stresses how serious this is. He says that taking part in an unworthy manner is sinning against the body and blood of the Lord.
Wow.
That's really strong language.
Yeah.
He's really highlighting the disrespect they're showing to Christ's sacrifice.
Yeah.
Through their actions.
Yeah. And so then he urges everyone to examine themselves before they eat the bread and drink from the cup.
Right.
He says this in verse 28. So what kind of self-examination do you think Paul's advocating for here?
Yeah. So given all that he's already said, I think he's calling on them to really look at their attitudes and behaviors toward one another.
Okay.
Especially in these gatherings. So, you know, are they contributing to division or are they promoting unity?
Yeah.
Are they showing honor and respect to everyone?
Okay.
Regardless of their social status, are they actually recognizing the importance of Christ's body, both in terms of his sacrifice, but also in terms of the church, the body of believers?
Yeah.
So it's this inward look to see if their actions are matching their beliefs.
Right. And he says in verse 29 that if they don't do this, if they eat and drink without recognizing the body of the Lord, they are subject to judgment.
Yeah.
And he even mentions that some of them are weak and sick and some have even died.
Yeah.
That's really sobering.
Yeah. And it shows just how seriously Paul took this issue.
Right.
You know, he He's not messing around here.
Yeah.
This is really important to him.
Right. But then he goes on to clarify in verse 32 that this judgment is actually a form of discipline.
Yeah.
It's meant to correct them.
Right.
So that they can avoid final condemnation.
Yeah.
It's like he's saying, look, I'm doing this because I love you.
Right.
And I don't want you to end up being condemned with the world.
Exactly.
So what does he tell them to do to fix this?
So he gives them some practical instructions in verses 33 and 34. He tells them that when they come together to eat, they should eat together.
Okay.
And then he tells those who are hungry to eat at home.
Okay.
Before they come to the gathering.
Yeah.
So that the gatherings don't turn into these divisive meals.
Right.
That end up resulting in judgment.
Yeah.
And then he says that he's going to give them further instructions when he gets there.
Okay.
So this is kind of a temporary fix.
Yeah.
Until he can address the issue more fully in person.
Right. It's interesting to me how this whole situation with the Lord's Supper in Corinth is so rooted in their social context.
Right.
And Dr. Metters also points out the connection between the Lord's Supper and the Jewish Passover.
Yeah.
Which would have been so familiar to these early Christians.
Yeah.
So can you talk a bit about that connection?
Yeah. So the Lord's Supper is really framed within the context of the Passover.
Okay.
Which really highlights the Jewish roots of Christianity.
Right.
And so some of the key elements of the Passover observance, things like the slaughtered lamb and the blood that signifies deliverance and the unleavened bread and the rehearsal of their tradition, all find their fulfillment and new meaning in Christ.
Right.
Like the Passover lamb that was sacrificed, it symbolized their deliverance from slavery in Egypt.
Yeah.
But in the Lord's Supper, Jesus is that lamb, right?
Okay.
He's the one who delivers us from sin.
Yeah.
And the unleavened bread, which was quickly made when they were fleeing Egypt, now represents Christ's body, which was given for us.
Wow.
So it's not just a historical parallel.
Right.
These elements are theologically connected.
Yeah, I see.
They show how Jesus fulfills the patterns of the Old Testament.
Okay.
Yeah.
That's really cool. And Dr. Metters also talks about how the Passover actually developed over time from this family observance into a national pilgrimage festival, as described in Deuteronomy 16.
Yeah.
And he even mentions its observance in Second Temple Judaism. So how does this evolution of Passover inform our understanding of the Last Supper?
Well, I think it helps us to see how rich and layered Jewish tradition actually was.
Okay.
You know, the shift from a family meal to a national pilgrimage involved changes in how the sacrifices were done and where they took place.
Right.
And by the time of Jesus, the Passover was like the central religious event on the Jewish calendar.
Wow.
Yeah. And there are even references to it in intertestamental literature like Jubilees and the Mishnah.
Mm-hmm.
And so this all points to how important this meal was.
Yeah.
You know, it was steeped in religious and cultural meaning.
Right.
And so the fact that Jesus chose this specific meal to institute the new covenant is really significant.
Yeah, that's a good point. And of course, the gospel accounts themselves, Matthew 26, Mark 14, Luke 22, and John 13, they all describe the Last Supper. But Dr. Metters really focuses on Matthew's account.
Yeah.
And given what Paul was dealing with in Corinth, this whole breakdown of community and focus on individual indulgence, do you see any echoes or contrasts in Matthew's account of Jesus's last meal with his disciples?
Yeah, I think so. In Matthew's account, we see the preparation for the Passover meal, the purging of Judas as the betrayer, and then the partaking of the bread and wine as Jesus institutes this new practice. And then we have that prayer in Gethsemane that follows.
Right.
And one thing that stands out is that Judas leaves before the institution of the bread and the cup.
Right.
So there's this clear separation between betrayal and faithful participation in this new covenant meal.
Yeah.
It's like Matthew is highlighting the importance of genuine commitment and unity among those who are sharing this meal.
Yeah, that's a good point. And Dr. Metters also mentions this detail about the hymn that was sung after the meal, probably one of the Hallel Psalms from the Passover liturgy.
Okay.
Probably Psalm 118. So what do you think is the significance of this?
Well, you know, Psalm 118 has all these messianic themes.
Right.
And there's that famous verse, "This is the day the Lord has made. Let us rejoice and be glad in it."
Yeah.
And in the context of the Passover, this verse is pointing to the deliverance that God provided from Egypt.
Okay.
But now, in the context of the Last Supper, it takes on this new meaning.
Right.
It points to Jesus' sacrifice.
Right.
As the ultimate act of deliverance.
So it's not just a general call to rejoice.
Right.
It's a celebration of God's saving work.
Exactly.
Through Christ's death.
Yeah.
That's really powerful. And finally, Dr. Metters talks about Jesus' prayer in Gethsemane, where he asks for the cup to be taken from him. How do you think this connects to the Lord's Supper?
Yeah, that's a really interesting connection. I think the cup in Gethsemane represents the suffering that Jesus was about to endure.
Okay.
You know, the weight of the sin of the world that he was going to take upon himself.
Yeah.
And that connects to the cup of the new covenant that he shared with his disciples.
Right.
Both speak to the incredible sacrifice that he was making.
Yeah.
And, you know, when he cries out on the cross, my God, why have you forsaken me? It really shows the depth of that suffering.
Wow.
He was truly abandoned by the Father.
Yeah.
Because he took our sin upon himself.
Right.
And that's what the Lord's Supper is all about.
Yeah.
It's about remembering that sacrifice.
Right. So bringing all this together, what would you say is the key takeaway from this whole issue with the Lord's Supper in Corinth?
I think the main problem was that the Corinthians had really misunderstood the meaning of the Lord's Supper.
Okay.
They had taken something that was meant to unify them and turned it into an opportunity to reinforce their social divisions.
Right.
They were totally missing the point of Christ's self-giving love.
Yeah.
Which is really sad when you think about it.
Yeah, and it's so helpful to understand the social dynamics of Corinth at the time.
Right.
It really helps us understand why Paul was so intense in his rebuke.
Yeah.
And why he needed to go back and reiterate the tradition so carefully.
Right.
It wasn't just about table manners, you know?
Right.
It was about the very heart of their faith.
Yeah, absolutely.
And I think this deep dive raises some really important questions for us today.
Yeah.
How do our own communal gatherings, whatever form they take, reflect the self-giving love of Christ?
Yeah.
And are there maybe some subtle ways in which our own social distinctions or our own self-interest might be undermining the unity and the purpose of our gatherings?
Yeah, that's a good question to ask ourselves. You know, are we really living out what we believe? Or are we just going through the motions?
Right, because the simple act of sharing a meal together, it can be such a powerful expression of community.
Yeah.
But it can also be a stark reminder of the inequalities in our society.
Right.
So how can we make sure that our gatherings are actually honoring the spirit and the intention behind the Lord's Supper?
Yeah, that's a good question.
That's something to think about.
Yeah.
So we encourage you to check out Dr. Meter's lecture for yourself and maybe even go back and read the gospel accounts of the Last Supper with this context in mind.
Yeah.
Because Paul's message to the Corinthians, it's still so relevant for us today.
Absolutely. It's a challenge for us to live out our faith in a way that truly reflects Christ's love.
It really is.
Yeah.
Thanks for joining us on the Deep Dive. We'll see you next time.
See ya.